Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Previously on The Score, Behind the Headlines.
So in the early 2000s then, the Robeson County Sheriff's Office basically gets caught up in this very large federal corruption probe, which they called Operation Tarnished Badge. And at least 22 officers were charged with crimes, everything going from perjury all the way up to drug trafficking.
I used to go down there with a 12-gauge shotgun and a Neapolitan Mastiff. Because people kept warning me to be careful. And because so many drugs.
Welcome to The Score, Behind the Headlines, Episode 3, Storytelling and Telling Stories. Behind the Headlines is an investigative podcast from 670 The Score. In Season 1, we're examining the 1993 murder of James Jordan. I'm Julie DeCaro with executive producer Tony Gill. Storytelling. It's at the heart of the criminal justice system in America. At trial, one side tells their version of the story, then the other side gets to tell their version of the same story. Then a judge, or in this case a jury, decides which story they believe. If you're old enough to remember the murder of James Jordan, you probably don't remember much about the trial or any of the important events that came afterwards. Like most of America, I remember hearing that Michael Jordan's father had been murdered, seen a video of a man, a kid really, wrapping in Jordan's jewelry in a homemade video, and hearing that two men were convicted of his murder. That's the story most of America heard. But in rural Robeson County, North Carolina, where the murder took place, there was so much more to the story.
I mean, it's the biggest case I ever tried. In terms of the publicity, in terms of the media scrutiny, the public scrutiny, there were a lot of doubts that were being expressed about whether or not these two young men were actually the people who killed Mr. Jordan, or were they scapegoats. There was a long period of silence that followed their arrest, which then led to a lot of speculation about, oh, this case may not be as strong for the state as we were led to believe.
That's Johnson Britt, the former district attorney who tried the James Jordan murder case in front of the entire world. By the way, he was only 34 and newly elected to the office at the time he inherited the case from his predecessor. He was also the guy who sounded the alarm that led to Operation Tarnished Badge, which netted 22 sheriff's deputies in Robeson County for various crimes ranging from drug trafficking to armed robbery. If you missed our discussion of Operation Tarnished Badge back in Episode 2, you definitely want to go back and catch up. And if you'll recall, Johnson Britt is also the distant cousin of Joe Freeman Britt, the world's deadliest prosecutor. We talked about him back in Episode 2 as well. Let's back up and introduce you to the two men at the center of the James Jordan case, Daniel Green and Larry Demery. The two met in third grade when Daniel Green moved to Robeson County from Philadelphia. The elementary school the two attended had recently integrated the African American and Native American communities, and the African American population at the school was relatively small. Here's Kyle Swenson, the Washington Post reporter you heard from in episodes 1 and 2.
They kind of had, you know, for lack of better words, I think that they were both kind of outcasts growing up. And, you know, so Green's from Philadelphia, and he moves to that area, which I'm sure was a huge culture shock, you know, as a kid. He also had a speech impediment, which was pretty bad, and he's kind of actually spoken very movingly about how Larry was basically the only kid on the playground who would, you know, play with him, this kid with a speech impediment. And so they had that kind of real deep childhood bond, which I think was very much enforced by the fact that they're minorities in this not only a white majority area, but an area that definitely has a legacy of white supremacy and, you know, whites being in power.
He's right. Daniel Green credited his friend with helping him overcome his stuttering and boosting his self-esteem. In fact, Daniel Green said of Larry Demery, "When you've got a person who won't pick on you, when he's patient and not suggest words for you, he was a friend all the time." Daniel and Larry remained friends throughout their teens. In fact, when a 15-year-old Daniel was sent to prison in 1991 for hitting another boy in the head with an axe, more on that in a later episode, Larry actually stayed at the home of Daniel's mother. When Daniel's conviction was vacated by a court and he was released in 1993, Daniel immediately reached out to reconnect with his old friend. And that's how it came to be that Larry Demery and Daniel Green were attending a barbecue of a mutual friend on July 22, 1993. And that's the end of the part of the story where the two agree. From here on, both stories diverge wildly from one another, with each accusing the other of being the murderer of James Jordan.
In order to give you the full scope of the case, let's start with the prosecution's case, which is entirely premised on the idea that Larry Demery was the one telling the truth. But when you have two teens, both pointing the finger at each other, how did prosecutors even decide who to believe? D.A. Johnson Britt says Demery's story was just more believable.
They both start off making similar statements, and ultimately Larry Demery broke or changed his statement and then began talking in detail about how they came in contact with the car, what they were doing, how it came about, who did what, who drove the car away, where they went. Did they know who they had killed at the time? No. But once they rendezvoused at Daniel Green's, the mobile home park where Daniel Green lived, they left Demery's car there. He got in. They drove down the road. It's not a highway. It's just a country road. They pulled over into a farm, a dirt road onto a farm, and they started going through his wallet, the items in the car, which included Michael's set of golf clubs with Michael's name on the back of it, newspaper articles about the Bulls winning the championship. And when they pull out his driver's license and they see the name James Jordan, they see all this stuff with Michael Jordan, they suddenly realize that they have killed Michael Jordan's dad, and they got to get rid of his body. Green kept up this story, and then eventually it begins to change, but for him it never changes to, oh, I was part of this. It was always someone brought us the car. It went from Larry shows up with these Continentals or Cadillacs following, these guys get out in trench coats. This is in August, in July, in North Carolina. They look like mobsters. They tell us to get rid of the car. We get rid of the car, and the body's in the car.
Attorney Hugh Rogers represented Larry Demery at trial, and he says all the evidence pointed to Daniel Green being the trigger man.
Most of the physical evidence that ultimately was recovered all landed on Daniel. Finding the gun at one of his relatives' house, that video of him rapping with the White Sox ring, and that may have actually been a Bulls ring, and he had a White Sox cap on while he was doing that with the ring, so a lot of that pointed directly towards him, and some other things I'm no doubt leaving out. But plus, he was, when they were in the vehicle, I think about 98% of the calls that were made by him. Nothing was really linked back to Larry as far as physical evidence. There was one phone call to a cousin, I believe. And that really, as I understand it, had to do with, was he interested in the car?
According to the plea deal, which kept him from being subject to the death penalty, Demery testified at trial that he and Green planned to rob tourists at the Quality Inn, just a couple hundred yards from the intersection of I-95 and US 74, and happened upon James Jordan while he was asleep in his car on the side of the road. Demery said Green decided that he didn't want just Jordan's money. He wanted Jordan's Lexus. The two planned to wrap Jordan up in duct tape and leave him by the side of the road, but that Green shot Jordan when he started to wake up in the front seat. The prosecution backed up the state forensics lab. that claimed that blood found in the front seat of Jordan's car was consistent with Demery's testimony, and that the gun used to kill James Jordan was found inside a vacuum cleaner at the home of Daniel Green's mother. And in that infamous homemade rap video, it's Daniel Green we see on camera wearing the NBA All-Star ring Michael Jordan had given to his father. As far as the prosecution was concerned, it was a carjacking and a robbery that started with Daniel Green as the ringleader and ended with the body of James Jordan draped over a log in a swamp in South Carolina. But Daniel Green's version of events in the night of July 22nd were much different. Green says that Demery left the barbecue around 1:30 a.m. to make a delivery. Green declined as he was interested in a girl at the party. Demery returned several hours later, according to Green, agitated and upset. He told Green that he needed his help. When the two left the party together around 4:30 a.m. or so, Green says Demery took him to James Jordan's car and explained that he needed help moving James Jordan's body. According to Green, Demery said he went to the hotel to make a drug delivery and that a man he met there sexually propositioned him, leading Demery to shoot him. Hours later, Green says the two teens stood on a bridge in Gum Swamp and dumped James Jordan's body over the side. Let's pause again and remind our listeners that we have no reason to believe that James Jordan was involved in any nefarious activity or that he sexually propositioned anyone. And the last thing we want to do is cast any doubt on James Jordan's motives or intentions. As far as we know, James Jordan was guilty of one thing: choosing the wrong place to take a nap.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Last summer, Daniel Green spoke to Dan Wiederer of the Chicago Tribune for a piece that featured prominently in our research for this episode and for this podcast as a whole. In that interview, Green talked about the moment he says he decided to help his friend. These are Green's words, but not his voice.
I just didn't listen to my conscience back then. I didn't recognize the voice. I guess it was maybe the mentality of saying, man, this is my dude. I'm a real man, like... I'm a real man because this is my friend. He needed me, and I was there for my friend. When I was a kid, I used to read these books called Choose Your Own Adventure books. When you make a decision, you turn the page. And that's like it was.
As a result of his plea deal with the prosecution, Larry Demery was sentenced to life in prison. And while the jury found Daniel Green guilty of the murder of James Jordan, they declined to sentence him to death, stating that they did not find beyond a reasonable doubt that Green killed, attempted to kill, or intended to kill James Jordan. So what are we to make of a jury verdict that finds Green guilty of murder, but not that he intended to kill James Jordan? Here's DA Johnson Britt again.
All the evidence was that Daniel Green was the shooter, and that was based on Demery's testimony. Over my objection, the judge allowed that special issue to go to the jury. And ultimately, I think it confused them. But at the same time, Demery had pled guilty to felony murder and then testified about what had happened. And so all the evidence in front of the jury at the time was that Daniel Green was the shooter. But you know, juries do strange things sometimes.
Daniel Green was ultimately sentenced to life in prison plus 10 years. He's currently incarcerated at the Lumberton Correctional Institute in Robeson County. Larry Demery is serving his sentence at the Scotland Correctional Institution 30 miles away. He became eligible for parole in 2016. For the last 25 years, Daniel Green has maintained that he helped Larry Demery dispose of James Jordan's body, but was not there when Jordan was murdered. And as we mentioned in episode one, some big question marks in this case remain, even after 2.5 decades. First, there were some pretty questionable decisions by Daniel Green's trial attorney. For example, remember how Green said he didn't want to leave the barbecue the night of James Jordan's murder because there was a girl there he was interested in? Her name was Bobby Jo Murillo, and there are photos of her and Daniel Green together at the barbecue on the night of the murder. She claimed she spent the entire evening with Daniel Green, and she was one of the few people who could have provided an alibi for Green at the time of the murder. But Green's attorney failed to put her on the stand to testify, even though he promised the jury in opening statements that they would hear from alibi witnesses. Oh, and the one alibi witness they did call? She had accused one of the jurors of sexually inappropriate behavior towards her when she was a teen.
Scott Rabb wrote an infamous story about the case for GQ, and he attended the trial. His opinion on Green's trial attorneys wasn't exactly effusive.
The lawyer in was shabby, and I don't say that as someone with a law degree, but someone who's covered plenty of trials over many years as a magazine writer. And the defense both youngsters. I mean, here's all you need to know: the kid who was convicted of murder, Daniel Green, is serving a life sentence, and the kid who flipped and turned state's evidence to testify against Daniel Green, Larry Demery, is also serving a life sentence. Angus was way over his head. I know what you. I love public defenders are heroes to me and to my wife, who's a legal journalist. I didn't mean to cut you off, but Angus was a very passive attorney.
Back in episode 2, we talked about Larry Deese. Remember him? Deese was a known cocaine dealer who worked with Larry Demery at Crestline Mobile Homes, just a mile or so down the road from Gum Swamp, where Jordan's body was dumped. Oh, by the way, Larry Deese just so happened to be the illegitimate son of, remember, Sheriff Hubert Stone. Deese was also friends with many of the sheriff's deputies and was closest to Mark Locklear, who headed up the James Jordan investigation. Deese allegedly rode around with Locklear in his patrol car during the time Deese was trafficking cocaine. Turns out that the very first call made from James Jordan's car after his murder was to one Larry Deese. Only the police never hauled Larry Deese in for an interview, and Green's defense team thinks they know why. Remember Operation Tarnished Badge? The federal sting that took down 22 sheriff deputies in Hubert Stone's office for crimes ranging from drug trafficking to kidnapping and armed robbery? Green believes Sheriff Stone intentionally steered the case away from his son, Larry Deese, and the drug trafficking in Robeson County that his officers were involved in. So, to recap. 1. A call from James Jordan's car phone in the hours after his murder was to the son of the sheriff. 2. The sheriff's son was engaged in a large-scale drug trafficking operation and had worked as an informant for the sheriff's department. 3. The sheriff's son was a co-worker with the state's chief witness, Larry Demery, who was also known to the department to be involved in with cocaine. 4. The two men worked within a mile of where the body of James Jordan was found. And 5. Lead investigator Mark Locklear regularly rode with the drug trafficking son of the sheriff in his patrol vehicle in the late 1980s and early 1990s. At trial, Green's attorneys tried to introduce the call to Larry Deese from James Jordan's car phone on cross-examination, but the judge hearing the case, Gregory Weeks, sustained the prosecution's objection that the call wasn't relevant to the case. But in 2017, Judge Weeks provided an affidavit to Daniel Green's defense team, stating that if he had known that Larry Deese was the son of then Robeson County Sheriff Hubert Stone, and that Deese was a drug trafficker, and that Green's accomplice, Larry Demery, worked with Deese at a mobile home park, he would have allowed the jury to hear the first call made from Jordan's cell phone. Johnson Britt, though, thinks the cell phone call to Larry Deese has been blown way out of proportion.
Every phone call that was made was documented. Who the subscriber of the number was also documented. The airtime for each of those calls was documented. During the course of the trial, I'm trying to remember, I believe Mr. Jordan's self-service was like AT&T. So we flew in someone from AT&T that knew about cell phones, knew about how phone calls were made, where what the
and basically its tower locations that were they were hitting on, and what the times signified. This was really the first case that I know of in North Carolina where evidence about cell phone calls was ever utilized. And so when, back in the day, if you called a number, there was a designation airtime on the bill, and airtime was assigned to the amount of time it took to, once the phone was dialed, to either you hung up or someone answered it. And then if it was answered, it switched to a different category and actually designated how much time, or identified how much time was involved in that phone call. With Larry Deese's phone call, minimum airtime at that time was a minute. The phone call that was made to Larry Deese showed a total of 1 minute of airtime, which the AT&T representative testified indicated the phone call was never answered.
But did the sheriff's office ever bring Larry Deese in for questioning?
On this, none. None. In hindsight, you know, maybe they should have gone to the person assigned whose number it was that was called. And then you end up with a bunch of negative interviews. A negative interview meaning being one that has no value. But that was known. The defense tried to introduce Larry Deese into this trial through cross-examination, but they could not make him relevant. And I know in the motion for appropriate relief that the defense said, well, I objected. Well, my objection was based on relevance. How was Larry Deese, an assertion that was going to be made without any foundation, going to make something more believable or not?
Britt also rejects the idea that Sheriff Hubert Stone was steering the case away from his son, saying that Robeson County was never the only law enforcement involved in handling the case.
It wasn't as if it's alleged in that motion, and as some people have written, that Sheriff Stone was the chess master moving the pieces. The pieces were already in place, and then you had really the Cumberland County Sheriff's Department withdrew from the investigation when they realized it happened here, and it became an SBI investigation along with the Sheriff's Department.
But it's hard to argue that a known drug dealer who works a mile from where a body was dumped and who works with one of the men accused of killing him shouldn't have been interviewed by local law enforcement handling the case, especially when he was the first phone call made from the car phone of the victim.
Making matters even stranger, Deputy Mark Locklear, who headed up the Jordan murder investigation and who was friends with Larry Deese, gave an interview to Green's defense counsel in 2015. And when Locklear was asked why Larry Deese was never interviewed about the phone call to him from James Jordan's car phone, Locklear responded, "It's a valid question. I don't have an answer. I can't tell you why he wasn't interviewed, but it was strange that he was called." Locklear also seemed surprised to hear that Deese's number showed up at all, saying, "I know Hubert Larry Deese. That number was linked to him? I don't remember that." Locklear went on to detail that Deese rode around in patrol cars with himself and other deputies, and that he hung around with the sheriff's deputies socially during the late 80s and early 90s, which would have been during the time that Deese was trafficking cocaine in Robeson County. In fact, Larry Deese was arrested for dealing cocaine prior to Daniel Green's trial. And remember the gun that was found in a vacuum in Daniel Green's grandmother's house? The one that prosecution said proved that Daniel Green was the shooter? Green's current attorney, Chris Mumma, told me via email that that gun was never conclusively proven to be the gun used to murder James Jordan. In fact, the .38 caliber bullet that killed James Jordan was never matched to any gun. And Mumma says the sheriffs only found the gun in the shop vac after interviewing Larry Demery, implying that it was Demery, who often stayed with Green's family, who told them that the gun was there. By the way, we've invited Daniel Green and his attorney to participate in this podcast, but they've declined while Green's motion for appropriate relief is pending. However, Green's attorney has made herself available to us to answer questions via email. We've barely scratched the surface on what Daniel Green claims the prosecution got wrong in this case. We've still got to get to the blood that was found in James Jordan's car, until it wasn't, and James Jordan's shirt that didn't have a bullet hole in it, until it did. We'll take a deep dive into that evidence next week. But we did get some news this week. As we mentioned in episode one, Daniel Green's attorney argued that he should be granted an evidentiary hearing to produce evidence that he deserves a new trial. Green's motion for appropriate relief includes affidavits from several major players in the trial, like Judge Gregory Weeks, who presided, and Jennifer Elwell, the FBI agent, who now says she's not sure if there was blood in James Jordan's car. But on Thursday, we received word that the judge announced he will not grant Daniel Green an evidentiary hearing, which means Green's route to a new trial just got a whole lot narrower, if not impossible. Green's current attorney, Chris Mumma, has filed a motion to ask the judge to reconsider his ruling, and she says she'll appeal his ruling if she has to. The judge is expected to issue a written opinion in the coming days. Next time on The Score, Behind the Headlines.
Do you have a state expert who's testifying that there's blood in the car in this case? And this was kind of in the early days of DNA and forensic evidence, when really it was kind of like, I think a lot of juries and just American citizens were kind of shocked by the idea, like, oh, scientifically, there's no way to get around this evidence. Like, we hadn't really seen the problems with forensics that would later crop up, get publicized as much.
She could not say there was or wasn't blood. Based upon the science at the time, she could say that in her opinion, based upon the liminal, that there was blood.
The Score, Behind the Headlines, is written and researched by me, Julie DeCaro, and our executive producer is Tony Gill. New episodes are posted Monday of each week on radio.com and wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Julie DeCaro, at TonyGill670, and at 670TheScore.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.